Welcome to AgTech 360, where we take a 360-degree view into emerging agriculture technologies of today and tomorrow. Our host, Adrian Percy, helps us to create robust dialogue among stakeholders in academia, industry, and extension, including researchers, growers, producers, and the overall agriculture sustainability community. AgTech 360 is brought to you by North Carolina State University, CERSA, the Center of Excellence for Regulatory Science in Agriculture, and the Southern IPM Center.
This is Adrian Percy with AgTech 360, and today I'm with Dr. Dinesha Seth-Kali. And Dinesha has a very varied and interesting background. We've just been going through her profile, which is full of numerous titles and numerous roles, but we won't go through all of those. We'll focus on a couple of them that I think are really important for this AgTech discussion. Dinesha, welcome. Thank you for your time. Really appreciate it. Maybe we could just start with giving us a little bit of description of your background, which I know you've got a lot of academic degrees. You're, of course, associated with NC State, a fantastic agricultural land grant university. But please tell us a little bit about your background first.
Sure. I, first and foremost, proudly come from a rural farming community in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains from West Virginia. And I left the foothills of West Virginia when I turned 18, and I have happily not looked back. As wonderful as West Virginia is, there are not a lot of opportunities for people who are maybe as ambitious as I am. I did my undergraduate degree in Indiana. I did a master's degree in Tennessee, and then I found my way here to NC State, where I found my true home. I love the land-grant university, and I love working here at NC State. After my PhD here at NC State, I took a postdoctoral fellowship, and I've stayed on the faculty here at NC State. I'm now an associate professor in horticultural science department and could not be happier with what I get to do for a living, which is essentially go outside and chase bees or butterflies, look at flowers and plants, and I get to call that a job. I love it. And when I'm tired of working outside, I get to come in and talk with other faculty members, industry people, work with students. It's, I think, the best of every world.
That's fantastic. I could have used you yesterday. I was chased by a carpenter bee, and I could have used someone that really knew that.
Many people do not like carpenter bees, although I do have a soft spot for them because they are good pollinators, but they can be a nuisance.
Yeah, we love the bees. I know that we were going to talk about a couple of your roles, which are actually quite different, but both of them have a commonality in AgTech, which is the purpose of this podcast. So, I mean, pollinators have become real mainstream in the public consciousness in the last few years. You know, large newspaper headlines around, you know, the disappearance of bees, their enormous impact in obviously food security and the potential results of losing, you know, large proportions of our bee populations. I mean, can you give us a little bit of an update of where are we with bees? Because there's a lot of concern. On the other hand, I hear other viewpoints that actually we have more bees around than we've ever had. So what is the truth of all of this?
Right. Well, thank you for asking me about pollinators. So it really depends. When we hear about large bee populations dying off, specifically we hear about it, you know, in the popular press or in you pick up the newspaper and there's a sensationalized numbers about bee deaths. Typically, we're talking about honeybees. And while honeybees are very important, they are a managed bee and they're not native. And so when we talk about pollinators, we talk about native bees, meaning small bees that you might not even think about. Although Xylocopa, the carpenter bee that you mentioned, are considered native bees, but also sweat bees and other bees that you might not notice. So when we talk about large bee die-offs, typically we're talking about honeybees because, as I mentioned, they're managed. So think of them like tiny livestock. You can almost count your bees, not that you would count individuals, but you would count your hives or your colonies of bees, much as you might keep track of your herd of cattle or goats. Bee die-offs are of concern to everyone in the communities. Sometimes when we hear about large bee die-offs, it isn't as straightforward as, oh, there was a pesticide applied and it killed the bees, or bees are dying in hives and we have no idea of the cause. Typically, it's a combination of factors that are causing bee die-offs, whether it's honeybees, although those are often and very closely related to pesticides. When those bees die, they're typically because they've been exposed to pesticides. or when we're talking about native bees dying off, typically we're talking about a complex of issues. Maybe it's stress because their habitats are under attack from urbanization. Maybe it's a combination of climate change and lack of resources, meaning they're not able to find as many floral resources or, you know, what they eat, right? Pollen and nectar. And sometimes it's due to pests within the colony. We're talking about honeybees or social bees like bumblebees or other diseases that maybe we don't even know about. So it isn't quite as straightforward as pesticides, as many sensational articles might have you believe. But pesticides definitely play a role.
Sure, sure. Understood. And then this urban angle to beekeeping and urban ag and this big movement, I guess, is across many cities in America and across the world. I was recently seeing a post from one of my friends in New York, and she was eating New York honey, and they're actually bees from the five boroughs, and you know, with different characteristics, so they claim. Very interesting. But for instance, locally here, are we seeing a lot of urban agriculture in places like Raleigh and beekeeping perhaps as well?
We are. It's, I think, very exciting. You're seeing more and more community gardens, and often associated with those community gardens might be a hive or two. We have a phenomenon here in Raleigh that there are actually beehives that are kept on the roof of buildings. And sometimes they are even right next to maybe a rooftop garden. It's not uncommon for small restaurants or hotel restaurants to have herb gardens and vegetable gardens on their roof. And there are often beehives associated with those. I think it's a great time to be in agriculture, and especially in urban agriculture, because we're seeing this embracing almost of gardening. And that includes having beehives.
Yeah. And I guess also, you know, given that there is, you know, a well-documented disconnect between those who are living in urban societies and their food production, this is a great way of actually learning a little bit about food production and beekeeping.
Right. And also, you know, you and I are sitting here worlds apart, but close nonetheless, and we would not be able to visit in person even if we wanted to because of the COVID pandemic. And I'm reading more and more about how people are having difficulty finding seeds to plant because everyone wants to plant a garden. I guess it's hearkening back to what used to be called the Victory Gardens. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're having an influx of COVID gardens. So people are more in touch with their food now than they have maybe been for a long time. And I think it's a really exciting time to be in urban agriculture.
So let's pivot to ag tech and how that is potentially being used in the management of bees or in the protection of pollinators. Are you seeing new types of technologies being looked at, tested in the marketplace with that end in mind?
I would say yes. I come at pollinator health from a plant side of things. And so I think what we're seeing in terms of ag tech or biotech might be the increased use of UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles. Some people call them drones. And looking at how large expanses of floral resources might influence pollinator communities. And that sort of thing is certainly, you can picture a large acreage of wildflowers along, say, the interstate. And it's certainly easier to monitor those floral areas with a drone, maybe, than it would be by foot. Certainly safer if you can maintain a safe distance from all of the cars driving by.
Yeah.
There's also something really interesting, and I have not had the opportunity to work with this group directly, but I know that there were a number of researchers here in RTP, actually from Bayer, before they moved to St. Louis. They were looking at using hives that were sort of maybe smart hives is a good term for them. And these hives would sit on sensors and would send information to the cloud that then a scientist or researcher sitting in their office or elsewhere off location could read information about the bees, and essentially it would give them information about the health of the hive.
Yeah, that's a really interesting technology. And as you said, I mean, in some of these examples with bees, you've got really massive amount of hives, you know, incredible amounts that are being looked after by, you know, single beekeeper. And And to have that capability to actually effectively detect remotely and understand the health of the hive is really powerful, and obviously helping the management of those bees.
I also think, you know, there's a lot that we don't know. You asked me early on about health of bees and how we monitor that. And essentially, there's more that we don't know than we do know. And having the data and having a lot of it, I think, can only influence what we know about these hives and help scientists make decisions about how we can protect bees in the long term.
Yeah. You are the director of the Southern Integrated Pest Management Center. You know, really interesting role, I guess, as this has evolved. And, you know, you're very much involved in urban agriculture, I guess, and the role that plays with pollination and with bees. So maybe just describe a little bit about what you're doing there.
Sure. So I run a program along with a co-director who is housed down in Georgia, the Southern Integrated Pest Management Center. And essentially what we do is we support other faculty members and stakeholders who are interested in doing integrated pest management. In our role as directors and co-directors at the center, what we do is we give the faculty members or our stakeholders resources that allow them to do their job in a more efficient fashion, or in some cases, just get a project off the ground. We do focus on pest management, integrated pest management, IPM. And so, for example, we run a small grants program whereby anyone in the South can apply for a small grant from our center. And we will support those grants. Sometimes they're focused on pollinators, but sometimes they're looking at using biocontrol in greenhouses in tomatoes. Or I have seen some projects that look at using electricity to kill weeds in xeriscaping. And so anything that's pest related, we sort of give out grants to allow faculty members to follow up on ideas.
So, Dinesha, let me talk about something related, but actually at the same time, completely different. But I know very dear to your heart, and that is CERSA, which is, I believe, the Center for Excellence in Regulatory Science in Agriculture, which I think is something very, very unique, not just here in the US, but actually globally. Tell us a little bit about this initiative and your role in it.
I do love to talk about CERSA. I'm really proud of how far we've come, and it hasn't been launched for very long. I think 2 years ago, we launched the center, and I believe, Adrian, you were sort of on the ground floor of coming up with the concept for the center.
It's and so thank you for that. Very near to my heart as well. Yeah.
So, you know, I came on board after the first meeting of the minds came together, I guess, in 2016 here in Raleigh to talk about the need for a center that would essentially help the community in regulatory science in agriculture, educate our consumers and our public, educate the next generation of regulatory scientists, act as a clearinghouse for information in an unbiased fashion, and also bring transparency to the regulatory system. Bring industry partners, bring growers, bring academicians, bring NGOs, bring the federal government all to the table to have discussions about how to facilitate and streamline these processes.
As you're alluding to, currently our regulatory system is a pretty all-encompassing, very technically driven, and very resource necessary in terms of time and costs of studies. But of course, that helps protect our food supply and also our the environment that it's produced in. So absolutely necessary. But I love this idea, and you're right, I was involved early on, but I love this idea of actually helping to educate the public around what products which are used in agriculture, what they actually are for, and how they're regulated and how safe they are. I mean, this is really important stuff. One of the things that the center will be looking at is new technologies. You know, we have a very established system for crop protection, pesticide type products, but those are generally synthetic chemistry. But we've seen a massive evolution into the biological sciences for crop protection, as an example. And now we have all kinds of different types of biological products. So is that something that the center will also try to address in terms of advancing the science around the regulation for those types of products?
So right now we are indeed focused on education and outreach. And what I see in our maybe medium and long-term goals are indeed to tackle those research questions, to look at the next set of challenges, the next advancements, and tackle them not in our individual silos, but as a transdisciplinary team where we have social scientists and pesticide fate scientists and policymakers all together tackling the same questions, but maybe from different angles.
Yeah, fantastic. And you mentioned the education in terms of the public. Is this something you're doing now or for the future? And what kind of groups are you looking to interact with? I mean, is it policymakers? Is it members really of the public? Is it children? Or is it all of the above?
As a dyed-in-the-wool extension person here at a land-grant university, I think the only way I can answer that is yes, all of the above. Or as I like to say, if you're interested in eating and you like food, then our outreach information is for you. That's a little tongue-in-cheek, of course. But right now, we have a number of outreach opportunities. And while I say that we really want to reach everybody, K through 12, students here in undergraduate classes, as well as graduate classes, professionals, regulators, federal government employees, industry, growers, we want to do it all. In order to make it effective and to get your message across, you really do have to think about your audience. And so we are tackling this in a few different ways. And because of our different methods, we're probably reaching different groups and we're missing others. So for example, our last workshop was something along the lines of using vegetative filter strips in pesticide runoff modeling. That's not going to be accessible for everyone, right? But for the people who work in that arena, it's very germane, it's very timely, and it's very important.
So you really want to be kind of at the center of all these different groups and bring them together, essentially. I'm sure that sometimes things can get a little bit heated because there are different perspectives, whether it's proponents of organic agriculture versus more conventional ag. Is this something then you're looking to really create these kind of platforms and forums to have these open debates?
I think absolutely yes. I know that I learn better when I am talking with people who push me out of my comfort zone. And I think what we're talking about are very challenging and uncomfortable topics in some cases. If you walk out onto the street and you talk to anyone walking down the street about, say, GMOs or genetically modified organisms or genetically modified foods, everyone has an opinion. They aren't always based in science. Sometimes they're based out of misinformation or based out of fear of the unknown. And those conversations can get very challenging, but I think that's the space where CIRSA can help educate our public so that when they're making decisions about these biotechnologies or whether or not they want to buy a food that's maybe got GM products on the box, at least they're making their decisions out of education rather than a place of fear.
Equally, you mentioned that one of the missions of CIRSA was to train the next generation of regulators, which is an incredibly important job because all of us rely obviously on them to ensure that we do have a sustainable and safe food supply. And I assume what you are trying to do is get very well-trained, scientifically based, balanced people that can really make these very difficult calls, either on regulatory policy or on individual products which are looking to be brought to the market by private entities.
That is a really good point. One of the messages that we heard loud and clear from our stakeholders when we were developing CIRSA and essentially establishing our mission was that while we have some very professional regulators in place right now, whether it's in industry or at the federal level or at the state level, and many of them were wonderfully trained, even trained here at NC State to go on to do other positions where their title is now regulatory affairs or regulatory policy director. However, they did not come out of a regulatory program. They came out of maybe a toxicology background or a chemistry background or maybe an agronomy background and are sort of learning on the job what they need to know. While there will always be some of that on-job learning, what we're hoping by developing the coursework about regulatory science and the advances around regulatory science, we're hoping to give the next generation of our regulatory scientists the backbone of that information so that they're going on to their careers with the solid base of knowledge about regulatory policy or understanding the literature behind the decisions that they're making.
Dinesha, thank you. for your passion and drive and determination to make a difference in this area, and actually a lot of areas, and we didn't even cover several of the titles that you have and roles that you have. But I think it's really amazing to see the breadth of your impact, you know, whether it be on pollinators or around the regulatory system. So thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it, and stay safe.
Thank you, Adrian. It was a true pleasure.
AgTech 360 is a product of North Carolina State University, CERSA, the Center of Excellence for Regulatory Science in Agriculture, and the Southern IPM Center. This episode was produced by Kayla Pack Watson, with host Adrian Percy and Center Director Dr. Dinesha Seth Carley. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at AgTech360 and send us questions and comments to agtech360@gmail.com. With AgTech360, we take a 360-degree view inside emerging agriculture technologies that matter. Thanks for listening.